Well, thank you, Brother Ken. Brother, pleasure to be with you. I see some of you whose cameras are on, but you're all welcome to turn your cameras on. In a study, you know, normally in San Diego, we all have our cameras on, and if somebody doesn't, we wonder what's the problem. So sure, there's no problem, turn your camera on. It is a study. Sometimes in our class studies, our studies tend to be intensely directed, let's put it that way. So, you know, we might have a little of that this time, but we really would like your participation. I'm going to give an introduction to the study, however, to kind of explain why this subject is of interest to us in recent times. And over the last half a year or so, it has been increasingly of interest to us. We had studies with brethren, you know, in various parts of the country about this. Some of the brethren online have heard those studies. And we've learned a lot that we didn't know. I should say personally, I've learned a lot that I didn't know about how some of the minor prophets handle Israel. Now, we're not going to talk a lot about the minor prophets today. We're going to talk about First Chronicles, the 20th chapter, something I heard Brother Stuart Sauer speak on at a Phoenix convention many, many years ago. And then we're going to talk about Isaiah 36, 37, and 38. Then we'll buzz over to Joel, the second chapter, briefly, and then to Micah, the fifth chapter. But I want to share the screen for a moment, and just as we give our introduction to the study. Oh, let's see, have I been made close to you? Yes, I have. So I'm going to share the screen. A little bit here. The deliverance of Israel. That's our subject for today. And there you have a picture of the waterfront of Israel with their flag flying. Much of what the prophecies have to speak about is with respect to Jerusalem. And so we don't have a picture of Jerusalem here. Now I'm hearing a little echo. For my own voice. I think that's coming from somebody somewhere. Maybe somebody could monitor that. And now, this is what interested us recently. It was the Abraham Accords. And that happened last year. That happened into the old administration. And when I heard the name Abraham Accords, okay, that struck a chord with me. I didn't even know what they were, but that name alerted me. And that was, of course, the accords between two countries, Bahrain and Israel, and United Arab Emirates with Israel. Now, where is Bahrain? Well, it's a very small little spot here. And as a matter of fact, you see a little red dot just kind of in the Persian Gulf. It's about 10 miles offshore from Saudi Arabia. There's about a 10-mile bridge, you can't see on this image, that connects the two. And United Arab Emirates is here. Now you see that both of them are across the Persian Gulf from Iran. And both of these countries are Sunni Islam. Iran, of course, is Shiite. And Shiite and Sunni don't always mix well. And so it's true that Bahrain and United Arab Emirates would like some protection against Iran. And that's what I think induced them to make these Abraham Accords. Now you see that the biggest state near these two states is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is kind of a client, kind of the master state for these other smaller ones. And without the agreement of Saudi Arabia, I don't think Bahrain or United Arab Emirates would have made an agreement, a peace accord with Israel. Just don't think it would have happened. So this tells us that a lot of these Sunni countries are bending towards cooperation with Israel. And of course, for Bahrain and United Arab Emirates, that included some military hardware. And there are Western bases in these areas too. Now you notice there's other countries here. Oman did not make an accord, but Oman has had trading agreements with Israel for some time. Kuwait did not, but they've had trading agreements as well. Qatar has some Western bases on it. So all of these countries are really not ready to fight Israel anymore. Iraq is not ready to to fight Israel, since the America kind of changed the administration there for better or for worse. And Saudi Arabia is more and more inclined to settle their differences. So that's what the Abraham Accords were all about. And since then, Sudan, which was formerly a hotbed for some terrorist organizations, has made an accord with Israel. And you know that they're meaningful in this because they've had to pay a high price for it. They owed hundreds of millions of dollars for past indiscretions, and they're agreeing to pay that. Malawi in Black Africa made an agreement with Israel. That's not too concerning, because too vital, because they weren't really at enmity anyway. And Morocco, way on the other side of Africa, has also made an accord. So those are the recent experiences. That's what keyed our interest here. Now I want to go on to another part of our resume and introduction to this study before we get to the participatory part. This is a little history of the conflicts that were, I'm hearing some clicking going on and I'm hearing some noises. So maybe somebody can just be careful on that point or monitor it for me. The conflicts of survival that Israel has gone through. Now there's a variety of conflicts Israel has had, but only three of them in the past have really been conflicts of survival. 1948, when Israel was declared a nation again, and the Arab countries around them immediately invaded to extinguish them, unsuccessfully. 1967, when Egypt and other Arab countries, I think Syria was involved there, were threatening, and so Israel saw the handwriting on the wall, and they had to preemptively attack. And in 6 days, the Six-Day War was completed. But that left Jerusalem in the hands of Israel again, because Jerusalem had been taken in 1948 by Jordan. And in 1973, Egypt and Syria combined together, ready to attack Israel, and they attacked them in a kind of a surprise movement. Israel almost lost that war, and God saved them. I think that's a little precursor of what's going to happen in the future. Israel is going to be at risk of almost losing. Now, what future battle are we referring to? Well, I'm referring to Ezekiel 38. And that will be a different kind of battle. And let's see, now I'm going to ask my sweetheart, Ruth, if she could come up here and close my door on my behalf, because I'm hearing a little feedback, I think, from down below. If she'd do that for me, that'd be helpful. So in Ezekiel 38, it's not an Arab coalition. In these three battles, it was an Arab coalition. In Ezekiel 38, there are no Semitic tribes mentioned particularly in the coalition against Israel. So things are changing. And when I heard about these Arab accords, and you realize that from 1973, there has not been a war with Israel. I mean, a survival war with Israel. For 48 years, things are changing. And now with the nations bending, the Arab nations bending more and more towards disengagement militarily with Israel and towards peace, I think we're headed towards the future conflict, which would be different than an Arab conflict. Now we'll see. I don't have on the agenda to get in Ezekiel 38 directly. We'll see. Maybe we'll have time to bend that direction. But it looks like that's where we're headed. Peace with the Arabs here, but a difficulty impending with another coalition in the future, Russia and other allies. Now, before I go beyond these three conflicts, there is something else that engages our attention about these 3 years. And that is 1948, 67, and 73 actually are meaningful years and dates themselves. How is that? You know, we don't hear prophecies about these dates, but there is something. Do you remember when Israel restored their nationhood in 1948? It was the first time, how many centuries, that Israel had an independent nation? Now, when did they lose their national independence? Way, way back. They lost it to Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. And you remember that Babylon ruled the Middle East for 70 years. That's when they lost their national independence. Now, in modern times, Israel began to be recovered and regathered, we say, in 1878. I think there's good reason for that, good evidence. Even the first prime minister of Israel pointed to the very same year because of the founding of the first Jewish colony, Petah Tikva. Notice that from 1878 to 1948 is 70 years. So Israel lost their national standing when Babylon ruled for 70 years. Now in 70 years, they have reclaimed it. I don't think 1948 was a random year. I think it was meaningful. Something more to that. We all know that the 1260 years in which spiritual Israel has been oppressed, what ran from 539 when papacy took over to 1799, but you know, there's an alternate 1260 for natural Israel. If you look on the Temple Mount today, you'll see something that doesn't belong there. It's called the Golden Dome. It's an edifice constructed to celebrate not Isaac's death, like Jesus, the ransom, but Ishmael's being offered by Abraham. It doesn't belong there. It was put up there 1260 years before 1948. I didn't know that a year ago. Or maybe 2 years ago. So I think 1948 was not random. And the reemergence of Israel as an independent state among the nations, I think, is remarkable. 1967. Okay, now I'm just going to mention how you might get this date, just very briefly. And that is in Daniel, the 8th chapter, you have a prophecy of 2300 years. Now we all take that 2300 years from the Persian Empire, the reign of Artaxerxes, when the 70 weeks began. I do that. Volume 3 does that. The Adventists do that. I think that's a good way to approach it. But there are two other empires mentioned there. Not only Persia, but right after that, the Grecian Empire. And then the Roman Empire. And when the Grecian Empire ran headlong into the Persian realm, we can put a year on that. That's 334 BC. And an old Greek brother, many, many years ago, 50 years ago, some of you might remember his name, but the Nick Curios, I think, was his name. A dear old brother, who wasn't a speaking elder that I know of, very humble brother. But at that time in 1968, he's Greek, remember, he knows Greek history. In 1968, I saw him at a convention in Phoenix. I was just a young man. He could talk to me. I was nobody special, you know. So I was just delighted when he told me that from the time the Grecian goat ran into the Persian ram in 334 BC at the Battle of Granicus, 2300 years saw 1967. When Israel got the Temple Mount back in their control again. And I think that's meaningful to the 2300 years. So I learned that 50 years ago from an old Greek brother as an alternate period that it deals with natural Israel rather than spiritual Israel. And then one more, and there's one third empire there. That's the Roman Empire. And that'll take you to actually when the little horn began to expand. That was in 387 BC. A lot to say about that. That's where a lot of Roman historians begin the emergence of Rome. If you take that forward, it takes you to 1914. Okay. So I just dropped that right now. But in Daniel 8, you've got 1967 is there. It's not a random year. And finally, in 1973, 25 years after statehood is when this came, 1973. Turns out that Israel, 25 years after the 70 years of Babylonian supremacy, 25 years later, their temple was built and things were doing better for Israel. So 25 years after here, Israel is saved from disaster. And from that time forward, they're doing better. They're doing much better. And I think 1973 is not random as well. Okay. Now, that's enough for that. Now, here we get onto the study itself. And here are five passages that we're going to look at. Actually, four. Second Chronicles, the 20th chapter. You'll see that in the question sheet. Isaiah 36, 37, and 38 is one narrative. The It's a narrative where Israel was almost destroyed, but saved. Now, that's a narrative that caught my attention in high school. I'll tell you more about it when we get there. Next, Joel, the second chapter, where Israel is saved in a miraculous way. And finally, Micah, the fifth chapter, where Israel is saved in a miraculous way. One moment. So those are the four passages we're designed to look at for the remainder of our study. So we're going to go, excuse me, I'm going to stop sharing now because I'd much rather see you all. And we're going to start with 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter. And starting there, we're going to read just the first four verses. And, well, I see some people. I don't see a lot of people, but I see some people on screen. So I'm going to actually ask you if you can unmute and read some verses for us. And Sister Jan Bora, I happen to see you there. Are you able to unmute and read verses 1 through 4? This is 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verses 1 through 4. And this is a scene where Israel was threatened severely by an enemy that was too powerful for them. And the narrative is going to explain how Israel is delivered from this imposing disaster. So the first four verses, Sister Jan.
Just a second, I'm getting there.
Okay, sure.
Brother David, can yes. I just say one thing about 1967? That you may have forgotten, and maybe that Greek brother actually got it from this source, Clark's commentary on the 2300 days, when he wrote in early 1800s, I think it was like 1830s, I'm not sure when Clark wrote his commentaries, but he predicted that 1966 would be the day of the date of the fulfillment of the 2300 days of Daniel. Now, he didn't calculate across the zero line. So if you calculate across the zero line, it's actually 1967 exactly is what he predicted, the 2300 days. That was in the early 1800s when Clark predicted that. Over.
Well, thank you, Brother Paul. I appreciate you mentioning that. Is that Clark's commentary, that same guy?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Brother I forget Paul his first him. Name. I should know that. Adam Clark.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Brother Paul has joined us in some of our studies on this subject, and he's told me that before. I forgot. So I'm glad he repeated it for the benefit of everyone. To know that Adam Clark, way back long ago, had a computation that would result in 1967 as well. That kind of helps us to recognize it's not just, wait, was that 1967? Oh, yeah. That's right, 1967, yeah. So that's very helpful. Thank you, Brother Paul. Okay, let's go on to 2 Chronicles 20, verses 1 through 4.
It came to pass, this is from the King James Version, it came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon and with them other beside the Ammonites came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat saying, there cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea of this side Syria. And behold, they be in Hazantamar, which is in Gedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah gathered themselves together and to ask help of the Lord, even out of all the cities of Judah. They came to seek the Lord.
Excellent. Thank you, Sister Jan. Now, there's some interesting points here. In verse 1, who are the enemies of Israel here that are coming to attack them? There's three of them. You won't maybe know the name of the third one, but what are at least the first two?
Moab and Ammonites. And
Moab and Ammon. That's right. Now, I'm sorry, Dan, I cut you off. Who was the third one you were going to speak?
I didn't say the third one because I didn't know.
That's okay. It says another beside them, so it doesn't list them there. But when you come down to verse 10, then the other one is mentioned as well, and that's Mount Seir. So that's the Edomites. Now, the interesting thing about this is that these are all relatives of Israel. Moab and Ammon were the sons of Lot. And when Israel came up to take possession of the promised land under Moses, still on the east side of the Jordan, God told Moses, don't get the land of Ammon and Moab, because I gave those to the descendants of Lot, and it's not for you. And Edom, they had to skirt Edom too. Now, Edom is, of course, Esau. So Esau was the brother of Isaac. So these are all relatives. And apparently these relatives are joining forces to destroy Israel at this point. So it's these three. And there's more story to say about Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir. I can't go into all the details. But it's a coalition of three. Now, it turns out that in the final battle of Israel, there is a coalition of three parties that muster the enemies of Israel against Israel. Now, you'll find that in Revelation, the 16th chapter. Sorry, I have to hold down the book. One moment.
David, you meant that Esau was the brother of Jacob, right?
That's what I meant. What did I say, Isaac? Thank you, Paul.
I think you said Isaac, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, thank you. Never go by what I say. Always go by what I mean. Sorry for the confusion, but I appreciate you clarifying for it. Revelation, the 16th chapter. Just going to read one verse there. Maybe we can get somebody to read that for us. Sister Joni Bruce, are you able to unmute and read for us? This would be in Revelation 16, verse 13 and 14.
Okay. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty.
And can you now skip down to verse 16 and read verse 16 as well?
And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon.
Okay, so this is where Armageddon comes from. And it comes because three entities, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, are mustering forces to Armageddon. Now, of course, there's interpretation here. I don't want to get too deep in the interpretation here, except to say that there are three entities that are mustering the forces for what I think is the last battle at Israel. And so I think that Armageddon battle is the Ezekiel 38 and 39 conflict. And then, of course, when we get to Ezekiel 38, if we do get that far, we'll talk about that again. So maybe Moab, Ammon, and Mount Seir, these three are kind of representing these other three. Now, they're related. Well, how are they related? Well, maybe it's because Israel is a Western country, and the dragon, beast, and false prophet are Western countries, Western entities, I should say. So in that respect, it's really kind of their own brethren in that respect. Now, I don't think it's the Arabs, because the Arabs, we've already seen, had conflicts in 48, 67, and 73. I think the Arab conflicts are winding down with the Abraham Accords. And Ezekiel 38 shows a different group, not Semites, involved in the final conflict. Okay. So this is the problem that Jehoshaphat is facing. These three are coming against him, and he has no adequate defense against them. Okay, now, this is a study. I tend to, even in a study sometimes, especially on Zoom, talk too much. So please, if any comments you have, questions, thoughts, other scriptures, raise your hand. Brother Jim.
Okay, I think it's interesting that in for Gideon, it just mentions three enemies, and they destroy each other. But here with Jehoshaphat, we have a little more information about the three enemies. And the beginning of chapter 20, it tells about some of the Ammonites being a third group. the same as, of course, the inhabitants of Mount Seir. And it does suggest that of the three great ideologies of the last day, that one of them is going to have a large influence over one of the others and perhaps subdue them before the Armageddon battle.
Thank you, Brother Jim. Would you venture to be more specific? I mean, maybe you're withholding just to be kind, but if you have, if you want to say more, you're welcome.
Okay, that's fine.
Brother David, maybe adjust your mic a little bit. You're starting to break up a little bit, Brother David.
Thank you. I appreciate the warning. Now, is it better or worse?
That's better there.
Thank you. I'll try to be careful. Brother Jim, go ahead.
Okay. I will suggest that the northernmost, which was the Ammonites, might represent the atheist, leftist forces currently headed by Russia, and that Moab would represent the Islamicist forces, and the inhabitants of Mount Seir, or Edom, would represent what we call commonly denominational or nominal Christianity, but that somehow leftism is to be somewhat at the head of the third group, Christendom. And it's interesting that we do have a leftist pope at the current time. So I'm watching.
Very good. Thank you. Now, by the way, I see some of you, but some of you may have a comment that I don't see. So just raise your hand electronically. And Brother Paul, I see you've done that. I think that's wonderful. Brother Paul, go ahead.
There's a book that I know several on the line here have read. It's called Titus, Trump, and the Triumph of Israel. And in that book, I know Sister Helen read it, and I highly recommend it to all the brethren. It puts together exactly those three coalitions that Brother James just talked about, the three enemies of Israel. And it's very, very interesting. It's written by Josh Reinstein, and it's very enlightening scripturally, at least for me.
Would you give me that book again, Brother Paul?
It's called Titus, Trump, and the Triumph of Israel.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Okay, now, we would love to read everything in 2 Chronicles 20. It's a long passage. I don't think we're going to be able to because time is, you know, has a way of getting away from us. So I'm going to go on to the questions. And the first question is, question one on the outline. I hope you all have the outline. If not, it maybe is in the chat area somewhere. Question one, in 2 Chronicles 20, when Israel prayed to God for deliverance, what did God tell King Jehoshaphat to do about the coming threat? You kind of have to read a lot in 2 Chronicles to get that answer. But what did God tell them to do? What did he tell them they wouldn't have to do? Maybe that's a clearer way of asking the question. Anybody have a comment? As Brother Lindgren.
Well, I think we read in the 18th or 17th verse, he says, you need not fight in this battle. Station yourselves. Stand and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf. O Judah and Jerusalem, do not fear or be dismayed. Tomorrow, go out to face them, for the Lord is with you. So they were not going to have to fight.
Okay, now that's a vital point. Now, if this is the last battle that Israel is going to have to be involved with, a lot of difficulty. In 1948, they did fight. 1967, they did fight. In 1973, they did fight. But in the final battle, if we're understanding this correct, Israel will not need to fight themselves in this battle. That's how much God is going to deliver them in an overt way. Now, maybe, you know, this is something that happened to Jehoshaphat. Can we be sure to carry that over in our application to the last deliverance of Israel. Well, we've got more things on the way in our study, but I think that that's the point. And I think this is how the last battle is going to be distinct from the previous ones. Brother Paul, go ahead.
But they do have to face them. They have to go out and face them. And I think that's an important thing that's already happening. They have to stand up to these outside forces that are trying to destroy them. And so it's a beautiful picture in some ways already beginning, in my estimation. We have to, you know what we really have to discuss, Brother David, and you probably won't get to it, and that's what it means to cover the land. Because, you know, in Ezekiel 38, it says that these forces are going to cover the land. Well, how can they cover the land and not invade? So that's something that really needs to be discussed in a symbolic way, I believe. Over.
Thank you, Brother Paul. You're right. Time is limited and we probably won't be able to. But if you have a quick comment on covering the land, I got my ears open. Go ahead.
I am not going to speculate.
Oh, okay.
It would be very speculative.
Oh, okay. I thought you maybe had a particular thought. Now, I know Brother Paul is inclined to think of this as something that's progressive, you know, from our day forward. You know, I take a little different tact on that. So Paul will be patient with me on this point. But Israel is, I think, in this time of deliverance, Israel is going to be, as Paul says, they're going to have to go out. They're going to have to confront the issue. I think God's salvation is going to take over there. Sister Kathy, go ahead. Kathy Brooks. Unmuted.
Yes, brother. I just wanted to know, are you going to bring in, the same names are in the 82nd Psalm? And the Lord, and they're asking, are you going to bring in that, or is that something that you think is in the past? Or I do believe that since the church should be gone then, because it says they're going to die like men. So I thought that was it. But are you going to comment on that, or you think that's another study?
No, Sister Kathy, that's an excellent question. I appreciate you bringing it up. Psalms 83, I think, is the one you have in mind. Am I correct on that? Where the various nations surround Israel and ready to attack them? I think Psalms 83, that's where all of the surrounding Arab nations are attacking Israel. I'm guessing that that's the psalm you have in mind. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I kind of think that that was what we saw in 1948, in 1967, and in 1973. We saw those enemies in Psalms 83 come against Israel. But when you finally go to Ezekiel 38, you find no Semites listed in the amalgam that's against Israel. So I think Psalms 83 is concluded by that time. Now, I personally didn't think that for a long time. I remember Brother George Tabak gave a talk in Psalms 83 decades ago. It's always been a good talk, kept in my back of my mind for a long time. And I thought, well, maybe the Arabs are going to join with the Ezekiel 39 coalition at the end. Maybe that's the way it's going to happen. But in recent times, I'm dissuaded from that. And I think George Tabak's approach really was the correct one. Now, recently, George and we have engaged on this point. And I think Brother George is still looking at some more Arab involvement still in the future. Whereas I'm inclined to think that it's over. So, Sister Kathy, I'm inclined to think Psalms 83 is over as of 1973. That's my opinion. But, you know, we're in prophecy here, and we're interpreting. Can't be sure. Brother Jim, please, go ahead with your comment.
I'll give a third suggestion, that I think I was kind of deemed as a heretic for thinking that this was not an invasion of Arabs against Israel. In verse 7, it speaks of Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre. Now, the Philistines are from Ham, and Tyre was from Japheth. So it's not exclusively Semitic tribes. And in verse 9, it speaks about Midian and Sisera and Jabin. And both of those are pictures of Armageddon. And so also in the next verse, two verses later, verse 11, it speaks of Oreb and Zeb in Gideon's time, and that also is a picture of Armageddon. So I am more inclined to think that Psalms 83 is a picture of Armageddon itself. That's view number three.
Okay, let me ask you a quick question on that, Brother Jim. Do you think that all of these nations, in Psalms 83, do you see the country of Jordan included?
I don't think that Jordan will be what's pictured here.
Okay, does it mention Ammon and Moab?
It does, but I don't think that literally will be Ammon and Moab and Edom for that matter. That this, I think, is using tribes that were hostile around Israel at that time to picture the various tribes around the world. And that's simply because the specific battles that are mentioned are pictures of Armageddon rather than intermediate battles. But that is my best understanding at the present time. I want to keep my eyes open.
Thank you, Brother Jim. I appreciate your comment. Okay, any other comments here? Okay, and let me ask this of Brother Ken. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, Brother David, just touching on that thought, when we look in 2 Chronicles 20:14, it says, then upon Jaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaniah, the Jehiel, the son of Mattaniah, the Levite of the sons of Asaph, came the spirit of Jehovah in the midst of the assembly. Now in the 83rd Psalm, it's said to be a psalm of the sons of Asaph. And that may be a connection between the 83rd Psalm and this battle of Jehoshaphat that we're looking at here.
Now, just let me refresh. I think you said this before, that in verse 14, Asaph, oh, I see. Okay, thank you. I got the connection now. Okay, thank you, Brother Kim. Very nice. I know you've done a nice study on the sons of Asaph. Okay, now, going on to question number two. How did God overrule for Israel's deliverance from Ammon, Moab, and Edom in this case? In the 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter. How did God overrule? That they didn't have to fight. They went out. But they went out with the leading band was not armed soldiers. The leading band, who was that? And how did God deliver them? Any comments on this?
They killed each other.
They all killed each other. The enemies fought each other. Okay, so they first did battle against Mount Seir, and then Ammon and Moab turned the sword upon each other, and the enemies killed each other. And Israel went out and looked, and they saw a bunch of dead bodies. Now keep that in mind. It's not a real nice thought, but keep that in mind for the next thing we're going to look at in Isaiah. They look out in the morning, and they find a bunch of dead bodies. The enemies have killed themselves. Now, who are the people that led the Israelites out to see this scene? What was their profession? A hint, they weren't the soldiers. Who were they? Anybody?
Levites?
But what were they doing? What were they doing? In verse 22. Brother Randy, I see you there. Could you unmute and read 2 Chronicles 20, verse 22, if you have that right at hand. 2 Chronicles 20, 22. And let's see, actually, let's read verse 21 and 22, Brother Andy. That would be good. Sorry, put you on the spot there, Randy, if you're able to unmute. You're muted, Randy.
I'm trying to pull it up. Second Chronicles
20, verse 21 and 22.
Second Chronicles 20?
Yes.
21 and 22.
Yes, please.
They were singers.
Singers, exactly. I said, that was 144,000. I don't know who that person is, but yeah, you got the right answer.
Joanne.
Joanne Dawson.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Brother Randy, go ahead if you have those two.
Yeah, 21 and 22?
Yes.
And when he had consulted with the people, he appointed singers unto the Lord, and that should praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army, and to say, praise the Lord, for his mercy endureth forever. And when they began to sing and to praise the Lord, set ambushments against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, which were come against Judah, and they were smitten.
Now, if you could read also one more verse, Brother Randy, verse 24.
And when Judah came toward the watchtower in the wilderness, they looked unto the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies fallen to the earth, and none escaped.
Okay. So they went out in the morning, and they sang praise. They knew they wouldn't have to fight in this battle. They sang praise to God, and after that, it was taken care of. But you notice what this means. This means Israel, by this time, I think, has turned to faith. Now, we're not studying Zechariah in this passage, but Zechariah, the 12th chapter, verse 10, says, then they shall look unto him whom they pierced and mourn for him as one mourns for their own son. And then I think is when God is going to deliver them. Now, if that's true, if they recognize Jesus by this time, how is it that they're going to recognize Jesus? How could they possibly, all of a sudden, instantly, suddenly recognize Jesus was the Messiah in this peril? How could they learn that under that distressful circumstance? Who's going to tell them that answer? Sister Shana, I heard it. I thought that you were trying to speak, but I didn't hear the word. So if you have a comment, please go ahead. I think you're... but Brother Ken, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Well, I think, David, from when you look in verse 19, the Levites of the children of the Korahites are now linked in with the children of Asaph. And I think there's a connection to the ancient worthies there because of Korah's relationship to Samuel and the beginning of the school of the prophets. And so what I think, what the point that you brought out in the study earlier was they rose early in the morning, and that this might be the raising of the ancient words.
Thank you. That's my opinion. I think the ancient worthies come back in this distress. When Israel prays to God for deliverance, then God will help them. But the way he helps them, now we'll see this later in Micah, we'll jump there a little later, is that he's going to, I think at this time, raise the saviors from the Old Testament. And they will direct Israel to the Messiah and the source of their deliverance. So I think that's why at this point Israel can praise God and thank him, and then see the deliverance of God unfolding at this point, not through their own armed might, but through their praise and thanks and appreciation. Okay, now we should go on. Any other comments on 2 Chronicles 20? Got to get to some other passages. Anything else, quick comment or question?
Just very quick, Brother David.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, we got to decide who Jehoshaphat represents. And I guess we would say it would be the leadership of Israel at the time of her deliverance.
Yeah.
And that leadership is sending out a people to sing songs, and it's an interesting song. It's the song of praise. I think it's the song of ascent. It's but we won't get into that. But so, who are these people? Who are these ones that they're going out before the deliverance they are facing the enemies and they're singing this song. And I think we have to take into recognition what's been going on for the last 20 to 30 years and this phenomenon of this faith-based diplomacy between these evangelicals who, you know, everybody says, well, they've got a hidden agenda and they believe that there's going to be the Antichrist in the third temple and all that. But the fact is they've had a significant impact in helping Israel through times of distress. And even to the point, you know, where I think they've had a significant influence in this continuing of peace with the Arabs as well. So we've got to take something into account. They're a vast army. There are millions and millions and millions of these people that have followed Brother Russell's advice from the 1870s in supporting Israel from a biblical standpoint. And so what do we do with these people? And that's all I'm going to say. But I think it's a beautiful picture here of these ones that are going out. They're appointed by Jehoshaphat, and they're going out to face the enemies with a song in their heart. The song of thanksgiving of the restoration of Israel, which means the redemption of the world. Over.
Okay, thank you, Brother Paul. Now, I'll just add a quick appendage to what Brother Paul said. In Song of Solomon, Brother Carl Hagen said years ago, pointed out that the lazy lover that doesn't rise to meet her Lord timely, among the things that she does, is she comes to the daughters of Jerusalem. Have you seen my beloved? And they say, well, what's so special about him? She says, oh, let me explain what he's all about. And this might be also this Christian influence on Israel to kind of help them too. Okay, a lot could be said there, Paul. Thank you. You're going to have to pass on. Brother Jim, I think I might have abbreviated something you had ready to say. Any comment before we pass on?
No, nothing special except perhaps the thought that Christendom might be beaten down before we really get to the Armageddon itself. That is, the third group gets beaten up by the first two until there's none remaining, and then the first two attack one another. And I mentioned to somebody at the county fair one time that if the Lord allows Christianity to be beaten down, that there's still a consolation prize for the Christian, and that is that the world won't be able to blame Christ for Armageddon.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we got to go on now to Isaiah. So this is question number 3. Isaiah 36. Now, you all know what Isaiah 35 is. That's the beautiful kingdom picture, Isaiah 35. So when you get to Isaiah 36, 37, and 38, we're going into 3 chapters. We won't have time to read them. Just kind of have to know what they're about. It's all one unified experience. And this is a time when the Assyrian Empire mustered their forces. And they came against Israel and specifically Jerusalem to destroy Judea. And I think this is a picture also of the end time. Now, let's look at 36 verse 1. Just talk about verse 1 just for a moment. Sister Alice, I see you online. I've always enjoyed your comments on Israel. Could you read for us, if you have it ahead at hand, Isaiah 36 verse 1. And Just verse 1 might be adequate for it.
Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them.
Okay, there's the enemy here, Sennacherib, king of Assyria. Now it's a long name, but those that were at the Florida convention heard his name come up in 3 different discourses. And all of the discourses, Brother Len is one of the speakers there, and Brother Len, Brother Richard, Doctor, they both, I think, applied this, the Sennacherib invasion, to a final experience of Israel. Well, I'm on track with that. I think that that's right. Brother Len, do you have any introductory thought to a comment on this point? Put you on the spot unexpectedly?
Well, I think that, yeah, certainly I think that seems to be the most logical talk when we look at Ezekiel 39, especially, and we look at all the comparisons of these battles. This battle with Sennacherib seems to be the one that really was the completing factor. And I think when I used it there, it was in connection with the descent, and that was more on, I think, I used that Second Chronicles, I think it was the 30th chapter or whatever, that one, with the battle where Hezekiah went out, and he had to reason with the viziers, the viziers there, and so it ended up anyways being a test on him. And then it was also the final thing that showed that God would deliver them. So I think it really is a complete picture that they knew they didn't have the forces. And even though they had already given away some of the things in the temple to try to appease them, it didn't work. The attack still came, and only God could deliver them. So I think the connection there was that Israel, I think, will continue to concede certain things, and they'll find out it won't do any good, and there will still be some kind of I think the final battle will still involve something to do with the land itself. So anyways, sorry for the mumble jumbo, but that's the essence of it.
Thank you, Brother Len. Appreciate your time. Okay. Now, Sister Alice read that this was the 14th year of Hezekiah. I just mentioned that I think that 14, that double seven, is the number that we see elsewhere at the threshold of the kingdom. Now, for example, I'll just refer you to Ezekiel 40, verse 1. In the 14th year after the city was smitten, there comes the vision of the kingdom, 8 or 9 chapters in Ezekiel. In Acts chapter 27, Acts 27, you remember there was a 14 days of storm, maybe representing 14 years of storm to come to pass before the kingdom begins. There's two other sources, the Genesis, the 14th chapter, and also something else about the tabernacle. I'll pass by those just for now. But the double seven, I think, is meaningful, that we're at the threshold of the kingdom, the second age of redemption. Okay. Now, in chapter 36, what you really have in Isaiah 36 is the letter from the enemy to King Hezekiah demanding unconditional surrender. And he's wrong. He says things that are just wrong here. In verse 10, I am come, do you think I'm come against without Jehovah? He says, no, no, Jehovah is the one that told me to come up and take this land. Well, you can bet that's not true, because Jehovah is the one that's going to defeat him and save Israel. So don't read everything, you know, that is claimed by an invading host. Don't believe it. And so maybe the people that are coming against Israel are going to think they do God's bidding, but they don't. They don't. God's going to save Israel. Now, in chapter 37, Hezekiah heard it. He rent his clothes. He went up to the took the letter. Now, you can go over to Isaiah 37:14. He takes the letter from the messengers. He spreads it out in the temple before the Lord. And he says, you know, Lord, what they say is right. Nobody has withstood their might. But you really are God, and you can, if you will. And he declares a fast, and all the little ones and the families look to God and are waiting for deliverance. And that is kind of what they did in Jehoshaphat's day with a dozen different threats. So I think symbolically, this is the same threat. So finally, when you get to 37, verse 36, I believe it is, let's read the deliverance that actually happens. Isaiah 37, 36. And let's see. Who's got that at hand? Sister Betty, do you have that open? Unmute and read Isaiah 37, 36. Betty, are you able to unmute and respond?
I'm sorry, I could hardly hear you.
I'm sorry, is my voice not doing well again?
I don't know what the volume is. I've got it turned way up, but I can hardly hear.
Okay.
Yeah, you are soft, David.
Okay.
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 Did you want me to read?
Yes, please. 37, 36.
And the angel of Jehovah went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, there were all dead bodies.
Dead. So God took care of it. Now you notice that Isaiah had even told Hezekiah, you will not need to fight. And as a matter of fact, the Assyrians will not so much as shoot an arrow into the city. That's how much I will deliver you. And I think that speaks just like in 2 Chronicles 20. Of God's remarkable deliverance for Israel in a miraculous way. And now, is my voice coming through okay now, but again?
You're back to being a little scratchy again and a little low.
Brother David, if you go to the main screen and click on Turn On Original Sound, hover over your screen, click on Turn On Original Sound. That should clarify it.
Brother Brian, I'm sorry. It's too technical for me right now in this midst of all these things on the screen.
Turn on original sound.
Let me just hold it so you can clarify. Now, Brother Ken, just keep me advised. Is it a little better now? Okay, I'm going to proceed. We only have a few more minutes left. I'll try to reconcile that before tomorrow. Okay, now in Isaiah 37, what you've just seen, that what happened is they woke up in the morning and they were all dead bodies. And I think that again, is a remarkable deliverance, indicative of what God is going to do for Israel in the final onslaught. Now, I want to talk about two other things in Isaiah. One of them is about the sign that God gives that Israel will be delivered. And that's in Isaiah 38. Verse 8. And maybe somebody could read that for us. Sister Teresa, I see you there. Do you have that at hand? Can you unmute and read that for us?
Getting unmuted. Okay. Okay, Isaiah 38:8, right?
Now let's read 7 and
behold.
8.
Okay. And there shall be a sign unto thee from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he hath spoken. Behold, I will bring again the shadow of the degrees, which is gone down in the sundial of Ahaz, 10 degrees backward. So the sun returned 10 degrees, by which degrees it was gone down.
Okay, now let me just suggest that we have an evidence that God is going to rescue Israel in the future. And that evidence is that the shadow of God's judgment imposed by the 10 horns of the European power through the gospel age, that shadow has turned backward. Israel is no longer under the shadow of the judgment of the 10 horns that controlled her for so long. And that is a token for us that Israel will be delivered by God in the future from the impending difficulty. The very fact that they have come back to the land, reestablished, and no longer in diaspora, telling us God is for them and is going to protect them going forward. Okay, now one other point, and that is in chapter 39. Can anybody tell us what is the problem in Isaiah? See, I'm sorry, 39. I should have said 38. In chapter 38, what is the problem that Hezekiah is facing? Other than the army that's outside. Any comment on this? Sister Kathy Brooks.
He's ill.
He's dying. He's sick. And so he's praying, and Isaiah comes to him, and the Lord hears sees his tears and his crying and gives him 15 more years of life.
Okay, very good. 15 more years of life. So in other words, now you know this is contemporary with the problem outside, because when he answers Isaiah, he says in verse 6, I will heal you and I will defend the city. So they're contemporary problems. So may I suggest that Israel has more than one problem in the final debacle. One is the surrounding enemy. But the other problem they face is the systemic disease of sin. It's going to kill them anyway, even if God delivers them from the enemy. So Israel needs more than just a military defense. They need a cure from the systemic sin, disease of sin. He's got a big boil on his back. If you go down to the end of the chapter, you find out that was the issue. So now let's read how that is resolved. Let's look at verse 21. In fact, that's adequate. Just verse 21. That's Isaiah 38:21. Sister Ella, are you able to read that for us? Unmute and read for us that
yes.
Verse 38:21.
Now Isaiah has said, let them take a lump of figs and apply it as a poultice on the boil, and he shall recover.
Very good. So you took a bunch of good figs, mashed them up into a poultice, put it on the boil, it drew out the infection. Now, I think these good figs might be the ancient worthies, that when applied to the systemic disease of sin in Israel, is going to draw out that infection, and they're going to live forever. Now, it would be real nice to make this picture of telling Hezekiah, you'll have everlasting life. It's not practical for Hezekiah. So they, how many years was his life extended as a token of this healing? How many years was that? Mr. Helen, did you get that number when you were reading?
I think it was 15, was it?
15 years. Now, I guess it was a different verse. Somebody else mentioned, though. Mr. Kathy did. Brother Jim. You're muted.
It was 10 steps, but 15 years added to his life.
15 years, that's right, 15 years. Now, you remember, we're going to come up with that number again when we get to Micah 5:5. You're going to see it again. Put them back in your mind. We'll be there just in a moment. Okay, so I think that represents the deliverance that God is going to work for Israel. I say we're going to get there in a moment. We're going to skip question 4. We'll get back to question 4. Let's jump right to question number 5 and Micah 5:5. So let's look at Micah. And Micah is living during the same experience. Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah. They both lived during the period of the Assyrian Empire. So let's see if somebody can read for us Micah 5:5. Sister Karen, I see you on screen. Are you able to get to that scripture quickly, Micah 5, verse 5, and read for us that verse. And in fact, read verse 5 and also verse 6. Now, I just want to say, Micah is talking about exactly the same problem that Hezekiah is, the invasion of the Sennacherib of Assyria. So go ahead, Sister Karen.
Okay, wait.
Micah 5, 5 and 6.
Yeah, 5 and 6. Wait. Okay. 5. And he will be their peace when the Assyrian invades our land and marches through our fortresses. We will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. They will rule the land of Assyria with a sword, the land of Nimrod with drawn sword. He will deliver us from the Assyrian when he invades our land and marches into our borders. That's NIV.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, according to this verse, who do you think these deliverers are? The 7 shepherds and 8 princes might be that will intervene for Israel in this case. Any comment? Brother Kent.
Well, the 7 shepherds, the word shepherd is the same as king, so 7 kings representing the church and 8 principal men might represent the ancient worthies.
Okay, I think that that's the point. That's a very common thought. The word shepherd, you know, it sounds like a lowly post, but actually a shepherd is an idiom for a king, because a shepherd rules his flock and a king rules his flock. So it's seven kings and eight princes. Well, we know the princes in all the earth will be the ancient word. Now, Brother Ken, let me ask you this question. Seven and eight totals to what number?
15.
So that ties into the 15 years, I think, Hezekiah had his life extended. I think the two passages connect together symbolically, that his extension of life is going to be the deliverance that God is going to reach for him. Brother Ken.
Just, you know, when we were studying 15, we were studying for your study, in John 11:18, it says, and this is when Jesus raises Lazarus. It says, Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem about 15 furlongs long. And we thought maybe that death, that sin, sickness of Bethany and Lazarus, the 15 to Jerusalem, the city of peace, may be another picture of that redemption from the sin, sick, and dying world to where Christ died on the cross in Jerusalem. Over.
Well, thank you, Brother Ken. Tell me that verse again.
John 11:18.
Excellent. Thank you. Very nice contribution. Okay, I want to read one more verse. Sister Karen, if you still have Micah open, are you able to read verse 7 for us? And this explains what the influence of Israel is going to be to other people. Go ahead, Sister Karen.
The remnant of Jacob will be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which do not wait for man or linger for mankind.
Okay, now my point here is that Israel has not fought. The seven kings and eight princes deliver Israel, and they waste the land of Assyria with the sword. Israel has not engaged in this fight. What they are is like a sweet, refreshing dew, and like a gentle rain in the morning when you wake up. That's a blessing that they're going to be for the remainder of mankind. Now, there's other questions could be raised from this prophecy, but we've got just 2 minutes, and I got to pass on. I want to get to Joel, at least to enough to read a little bit in Joel. So let's go to Joel, the second chapter. We're going to go to verse 12 in Joel 2, just enough to connect that this is also a deliverance of Israel. Joel also was a contemporary of Isaiah and of Micah. And let's read Joel 2, verse 12 and verse 13. Joel 2, 12 and 13. Who can volunteer to read that for us? Let's see. Sherelle, please, yes. Sherelle, go ahead.
Okay, Joel 2, 12 and 13. Now therefore, says the Lord, turn to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. So rend your heart and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and he relents from doing harm.
Thank you. And now in verse 14, who knows? Maybe he'll leave a blessing. And in fact, he will. So here's what God says. Verse 17, 16 and 17. Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders. And now verse 17. Sister Teresa Sutherland, could you read verse 17 for us? Joel 2, 17.
Yes, I can. Let the priests and ministers of the Lord weep between the porch and the altar, and let them say, spare thy people, O Lord, and give not thine heritage to reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, where is their God?
And then read verse 18 as well, if you would. We'll find the result of all this.
Okay. Then will the Lord be jealous for his land and pity his people?
Yes. And then in verse 19 and forward, he's going to send them the corn, the wine, and the oil. Those are the three ingredients in the Feast of Tabernacles. We're coming into the kingdom now at this point. And in verse 20, I will remove far off from you the northern army and will drive into a land barren and desolate, and Israel is delivered. And after that, you go to the end of the chapter, God pours out his spirit upon all flesh. We enter the kingdom. So here again, Israel does not fight. They pray, they gather, they fast, they weep, they praise the Lord, and the Lord delivers them. So to summarize our study, just going a little over time here, we've seen three instances. 2 Chronicles 20, Jehoshaphat, delivered without military intervention by Israel. Isaiah 36, 37, and 38, the Sennacherib invasion. God delivers them without military intervention by Israel. Joel, the second chapter, great invading host from the north. That's the Sennacherib army again. They pray, they fast, they weep, they plead. God delivers them without any military intervention from Israel, and then brings them into the kingdom, and the millennial kingdom proceeds. It's just a beautiful prospect. And so Israel has fought in three wars of survival, 48, 67, and 73. God preserved them. And embedded in these minor prophecies are testimonies of those deliverances when Israel was like a lion in a flock of sheep, like a fire in a sheep, burning through a sheep. Israel has been militarily effective by God's grace. But in the last battle, in the last deliverance, God takes over totally.
Hey.
I think that's why the nations are going to recognize God has done this. And they're going to report back to the nations. This is God's hand, not just another fluke of deliverance. God has done this.